and sing better than the Fiddler's Convention. We was up long before day singing and frolicking. It was fine. That's all right, if they got nothing better to do.
Meat was before them, piled high on the plates. The Baxters fell too. Chapter 9. A soft rain fell in the night. The April morning that followed was clear and luminous. The young corn lifted pointed leaves and was inches higher. The cowpeas in the field beyond were breaking the ground. The sugar cane was needle points of greenness against the tawny earth. It was strange, Jody thought. Whenever he'd been away from the clearing and came home again, he noticed things that he'd never noticed before, but that had been there all the time. Young mulberries were clustered along the boughs, and before he went to the foresters, he had not even seen them. The Scuppernong grapevine, a gift from his mother's kin in Carolina, was in bloom for the first time, fine and lace-like. The wild golden bees had found its fragrance and were standing on their heads to guzzle its thin honey. For 2 days he had filled his stomach so richly that this morning he felt a little languid and was not truly hungry. His father was up and out ahead of him, as usual. Breakfast was ready in the kitchen, and his mother was tending the sausages in the smokehouse. The wood box was low, and Jody idled outside to fill it. He was in a mood for work, but it must be something gentle and unhurried. He made 2 leisurely trips to fill the wood box. Old Julia was dragging herself around in search of Penny. Jody stooped to stroke her head. She seemed to share the sense of well-being that filled the clearing. Or perhaps she understood that she had been spared a time longer to run through swamp and scrub and hammock. She wagged her long tail and stood quiet under his petting. The deepest wound was still raw and angry, but the others were healing. Jody saw his father moving across the road toward the house from the barns and lot. He dangled a strange object. He called to Jody.
"I got a mighty curious something."
Jody ran to him. The limp object was an animal, at once strange and familiar. It was a raccoon, but instead of being the usual iron gray, it was all a creamy white. He couldn't believe his eyes.
"How come it white, Pa? Is it old granddaddy coon?"
"That's what's so curious. A coon don't never get to where he's white-headed, no sir. It's one of them rare things the books calls a albino, born white. And look, them rings on its tail, them that's due to be dark, they ain't no more'n cream-colored."
They crouched in the sand and examined the coon.
"Were it in the trap, Pa?"
"In the trap. Bad hurted, but not dead. I'll declare I hated a killing of it."
Jody felt a sense of loss that he hadn't known the albino coon alive.
"Leave me totem, Pa."
He cradled the dead animal in his arms. The pale fur seemed softer than ordinary. The belly fur was as soft as the fluff of new-hatched biddies. He stroked it.
"I'd have loved to have catched him, leetle Pa, and raised him."
"He'd have been a purty pet, all right, but likely just as mean as ary other coon."
They turned in at the gate and around the side of the house to the kitchen.
"Father Wing said none of his coons wasn't never particular mean."
"Yes, but a forester wouldn't scarcely notice if he was to get bit."
"Likely he'd bite right back, eh, Pa?"
They laughed together, picturing their neighbors. Ma Baxter met them at the door. Her face brightened seeing the animal.
"You got him! Good! That's what's been a-going with my hands."
"But Ma," Jody protested, "look at him. He's white. He's a curiosity."
"He's a thieving varmint right on," she said indifferently. "Is the hide worth more'n usual?"
Jody looked at his father. Penny was deep in the wash basin. He opened one bright eye among the soap suds and winked at his son.
"Likely ain't worth a nickel," he said carelessly. "Jody's been a-wantin' of a little knapsack. Just as good to leave him use up the hide."
Next to having the albino coon alive, nothing could be finer than a knapsack of the soft, curious fur. Jody's mind was full of it. He couldn't eat his breakfast. He wanted to show his gratitude.
I can clean the water troughs, Pa, he said.
Penny nodded. I keep hoping each year come spring to hire us a deep well dug. Then them water troughs could fill with trash and welcome. But bricks is mighty high.
I'd not know what 'twas not to be sparing of my water, Ma Baxter said. For 20 years I've been sparing.
Now be patient, Ma, Penny said.
His face furrowed. Jody knew that the lack of abundant water was a trial to his father, and a greater hardship than for mother or son. Jody was held accountable for wood, but it was Penny himself who slung the ox yoke across his narrow shoulders, hung the great hewn cypress buckets at either end, and trudged up and down the sandy road from the clearing to the sinkhole, where seepage alone built pools of water, amber-colored from leaf mold and filtered by the sand. It was as though the labor were Penny's apology to his family for having established them on land so arid, when creeks and rivers and good wells flowed not many miles away. For the first time, Jody wondered why his father had chosen to inhabit this place, thinking of the pools on the steep side of the sinkhole that must be cleared. He was almost tempted to wish that they had lived on the river with Grandma Hutto. Yet the clearing, the island of tall pines, made up the world. Life in other places was only a tale that was told, as Oliver Hutto told of Africa and China and Connecticut. His mother said,
You better put a biscuit, too, and some meat in your pocket. You ain't et.
He filled his pockets.
You know what I wished I had, Ma? A pouch like a possum to tote things.
The Lord put your stomach inside you a purpose. He meant you to put your rations inside you when your Ma sets 'em on the table.
He rose and ambled to the door. Penny said,
You get on to the sinkhole, son, and I'll foller. Time I've skinned out your coon hide.
The day was bright and windy. Jody took a grubbing hoe from the shed behind the house and strolled toward the road. The mulberry trees by the fence were a sharp green. His mother's favorite hen clucked to her biddies from the slat coop. He scooped up a small ball of yellow down and held it against his cheek. Its cheepings shrill in his ear. He released it, and it scurried for shelter under the fat hen's wings. The yard would soon need hoeing. The walk from the front steps to the gate needed hoeing, too. The walk was bordered with cypress slats, but the weeds crept under and over and grew impudently among the amaryllis that lined the pathway. The lavender petals of the chinaberry blooms were falling. Jody scuffed his bare toes through them and went through the gate. He hesitated. The barns were tempting. There might be a new hatching of biddies. The calf might have a different look from yesterday. And if he could think of a good reason to give himself for prowling about, the increasingly unwelcome job of cleaning the water troughs might be that much longer postponed. Then it occurred to him that if he finished the cleaning in short order, he might be through for the day. He swung the grubbing hoe over his shoulder and set off at a trot toward the sinkhole. The end of the world, he thought, might be like the sinkhole. Fodderwing had said that it was empty and dark, with only clouds to ride on. But no one knew. Certainly reaching it must feel as it felt to reach the edge of the sinkhole. Jody wished that he had been the first to discover it. He turned the corner of the fence row. He left the road and took the trail. It was narrow, hemmed in by briars. He pretended that he didn't know there was a sinkhole. He passed a dogwood tree. It was a landmark. He closed his eyes and whistled carelessly. He put his feet ahead of him slowly. In spite of his determination, in spite of squeezing his eyelids tight, he couldn't make himself go farther with his eyes shut. He opened them and walked with a sense of relief the last few steps to the edge of the great limestone sink. A small world lay at his feet. It was deep and concave, like a great bowl. Fodderwing said that a bear as big as God had scooped out a pawful of earth to get a lily root. Jody knew the truth from his father. It was only that underground rivers ran through the earth and swirled and eddied beneath the surface and changed their courses. This was especially so where there were streaks of limestone, as here. The limestone was soft and crumbling before the air touched and hardened it. Sometimes, without reason, without warning, after long rains, perhaps, a section of earth sank in, gently and almost without sound, and a deep cavity marked the place where once had run, darkly and unseen, a river. Sometimes the sinkhole was a few feet only in depth and width. Baxter's sinkhole was 60 feet deep. It was so wide that Penny's old muzzle loader couldn't hit a squirrel from one side to the other. The sinkhole was as round as though it had been dug so on purpose. Staring into it, it seemed to Jody that the truth of its fashioning was more fantastic than the tales of Fodderwing. The hole was older than Penny Baxter. Penny said he could remember when the trees that lined its steep banks were no larger much than saplings. Now they were of great size. A magnolia that grew halfway up the east bank had a trunk as broad as the millstone with which the Baxters ground their meal. A hickory was as thick as a man's thigh. A live oak spread its branches across half the sinkhole. Smaller trees, sweet gum and dogwood, ironwood and holly, grew lushly up and down the banks. Palmettos thrust tall spears among them. Giant ferns grew from top to bottom. Jody looked down into a great cupped garden, feathered with green leaves, cool and moist, and always mysterious. The sinkhole was set in the arid scrub, at the core of the Pine Island, like a lush green heart. The trail to the bottom of the sinkhole led down the west bank. It was worn deep into the sand and limestone by the years of Penny Baxter's feet, leading his stock to water. In the driest weather, there was a continual seepage which dripped down the banks and came to gather at the bottom in a shallow pool. The water was stagnant and clouded by the comings and goings of the animals who watered there. Only Penny's hogs used it for drinking and wallowing. For the other stock and for his own family's use, Penny had an ingenious arrangement. Up the east or opposite bank from the trail, he had cut out of the limestone strata a series of troughs to catch and hold the filtered seepage. The lowest trough was shoulder high from the bottom of the sinkhole. Here he led the cow and calf to water and his horse. Here, in his young manhood, he had led the yoke of cream-colored oxen with which he had cleared his land. A few yards higher up, he had cut a pair of deeper troughs. Here his wife brought her block and paddle and came to do her washing. A portion of the bank bore a milky whitewash from the years of her soap suds. For her annual quilt washing, she caught rainwater. At the last, high above the stock trough and the wash troughs, lay a deep, narrow trough that gathered water used only for cooking and drinking. The bank above was so steep that none of the larger animals disturbed the water. The deer that came, the bears, the panthers, all used the west trail and watered either at the pool itself or at the stock trough. Squirrels drank from the upper trough and occasionally a wildcat, but for the most it was untouched by anything but Penny's gourd, dipping into it to fill his cypress buckets. Jody jolted down the trail, bracing himself against the steepness with the grubbing hoe. It made a clumsy stalk, catching in the wild grapevines. The descent always excited him. Step by step, the banks lifted above him. Step by step, he passed the tops of trees. A breath of wind eddied into the green bowl, stirring waves of coolness. The leaves fluttered their thin hands. The ferns bent a moment to the ground. A redbird swung in an arc across the sinkhole. It turned and dropped down to the pool like a bright leaf falling. Seeing the boy, it whirred up and away. Jody knelt by the pool. The water was clear, for the hogs were feeding to the north in the marshy prairies and had no need of the sinkhole. A small green frog eyed the boy from a partly submerged twig. The nearest water was a couple of miles away. It seemed amazing that frogs should travel so far to settle in a small and distant pool. He wondered if the first frog migrants had known that there was water here when they hopped to the rim of the sinkhole and hesitated on their green haunches. Penny said that once in rainy weather, he had seen a line of frogs in single file, like marching soldiers crossing the dry, flat woods. Did they move blindly or with knowledge? Penny didn't know. Jody flipped a frond of fern into the pool, and the frog dove and hid himself in the soft muck. A sense of aloneness that was not lonely came to the boy. He decided that when he was grown, he would build himself a little house beside the pool. The animals would become used to it, and he would look out of the windows on moonlit nights and see them drinking. He crossed the flat floor of the sinkhole and climbed a few feet to reach the stock trough. It was awkward, bringing the grubbing hoe over his shoulder and into the trough. He discarded it and went at his work with his two hands. An accumulation of leaves and sand had left a thick layer. He dug and scraped vigorously. He worked against the creeping moisture, trying to hold the trough dry and empty for an instant. The seepage had returned by the time he took his hands away. The limestone trough was white and clean. He left it with satisfaction and moved higher up the bank to the more laborious work of scouring out the larger wash troughs. Constant use kept these comparatively free from leaves, but the soap suds in time made them slippery. He climbed a sweet gum and gathered an armful of Spanish moss. It made good scouring material. He scooped sand from a bare spot on the bank and used it with the moss. He was tired when he reached the drinking trough at the top. The incline was so steep that by resting his belly flat against the bank, he needed only to lower his head like a fawn to drink. He ran his tongue up and down the length of the trough. He darted it in and out and leaned back to watch the ripples. He wondered whether a bear lapped water like a dog or sucked it in like a deer. He imagined himself a bear and drank both ways, deciding. Lapping was slower, but he choked when he sucked the water in. He couldn't decide. Penny would know how a bear drank. He'd probably actually seen them. Jody buried his face completely in the water. He turned it from side to side so that first one cheek and then the other was laved and cooled. He stood on his head in the trough, resting his weight on the palms of his hands. He tried to see how long he could hold his breath. He made bubbles. He heard his father's voice at the bottom of the sinkhole.
Son, how come that water to feel so good to you? Put the same thing in the wash basin, you act like 'twas something nasty.
He turned, dripping.
Pa, I never heard you coming.
You had your dirty little old face too deep in what your poor pa was fixing to take a drink of.
I wasn't dirty, pa. The water ain't riled.
I ain't that thirsty.
Penny climbed the bank and examined the lower troughs. He nodded. He leaned over the rim of the wash trough and chewed a twig.
I declare, he said, your ma purely shocked me when she said 20 years. I just hadn't ever sat down and reckoned the time. The years have slipped by me one by one, me not noticing or counting. Every spring I'd figured to get your ma well dug. Then I'd need a ox or the cow'd bog down and perish, or one of the young'uns would put in and die, and I'd have no heart for well-dinged, and medicine to pay for. Bricks so terrible high. When I begun digging once it and got no water at 30 feet, I knowed I was in for it. But 20 years is too long to ask airy woman to do her washing on a seepage hillside.
Jody listened gravely. He said,
"We'll get her a well one day."
20 years, Penny repeated. But always something interfering, and the war, and then the land to be cleared all over again.
He stood leaning against the trough, looking backward along the years.
When I first come here, he said, when I picked this place and come to it, I hoped...
The morning's question came to Jody's mind again.
How come you to pick it, Pa?
Well, I picked it because...
His face puckered, his mind seeking words.
I just craved peace, was all. He smiled. Out here, I got it. Excusing the bears and panthers and wolves and wildcats, and now and again your ma.
They sat in silence. The squirrels began to stir in the treetops. Suddenly, Penny poked Jody in the ribs with his elbow.
Look at that scaper peeking at us.
He pointed to a sweet gum. A half-grown raccoon was peering around the side of the trunk, a dozen feet from the ground. It saw itself observed and pulled back out of sight. In an instant, the masked face looked again. Penny said,
I reckon we be as curious to the creeters as they be to us.
How come some is skeert and some is bold?
That I don't know. It depend likely on how young a creeter's scared. They don't seem to be no rule for it. I mind me once it. I'd been hunting all morning. This were over on Wildcat Prairie. And I set down under a live oak and made me a little fire to warm me and cook me a bit of bacon. Well, whilst I was setting there, a fox walked right up to other side of the fire and lay down. I looked at him, and he looked at me. I figured maybe he were hungry. I taken a piece of meat, and I jobbed it on a long stick, and I held it out to him. I held it right over his nose. Now, a fox is mighty wild, and I ain't never knowed one to get that hungry to where he wouldn't run. And you know that fox laid there right on, looking at me, and never et nor run.
I'd love to have seed him. What you figure made him lay there, Pa, looking at you?
It's been a puzzlement to me all these years since it happened. All I can figure is the dogs had run him until he got heated and his brains was cooked. I figure, for some reason, that fox were cold out crazy.
The coon had moved into full view. Jody said,
Pa, I wished I had me something to pet and play with like Fodderwing. I wished I had me a coon or a bear cub or sich as that.
Penny said,
You know how your ma rares. I'd not mind it, for I love the creeters. But time's been hard and rations scarce, and your ma's the one to say.
I'd love a baby fox or a baby panther. Can you tame 'em? Do you get 'em young?
You can tame a coon, you can tame a bear, you can tame a wildcat, and you can tame a panther.
He pondered. His mind went back to his father's sermons.
You can tame everything, son, excusing the human tongue.
Chapter 10 Jody lay comfortably ill, recovering from the fever. His mother called it the fever, so he didn't argue. He thought privately that too much half-ripe briar berries might have something to do with his ailment. Treatment for such things was always much more violent than treatment for the fever. His mother had observed his shaking, had laid her big hand on his forehead, and said, "Get into the bed. You got chills and fever." He had said nothing. She came into the room now with a cup of steaming liquid. He eyed it anxiously. For 2 days she had been giving him lemon leaf tea. It was aromatic and pleasant. When he had grumbled about its tartness, she had added a teaspoon of jelly to it. He wondered if now, in the mysterious wisdom that sometimes descended on her, she had discovered the truth. If she guessed that his trouble had been the colic, the medicine she held would be either snake root tonic or a blood purifier made from Queen's Delight, both of which he abominated.
"If your pa'd only plant me a root of fever grass," she said, "I could get both of you well of the fever in no time. 'Tain't decent not having fever grass in the yard."
"What you got in the cup, Ma?"
"None of your business. Open your mouth."
"I got a right to know. Supposing you killed me and I never knowed what medicine you give me."
"It's mullein tea if you got to know. It come to me. Could be you was coming down with the measles."
"'Tain't the measles, Ma."
"How'd you know? You ain't never had 'em. Open your mouth. If 'tain't the measles, this here won't hurt you.
If 'tis the measles, it'll bring out the rash."
The thought of bringing out a rash was tempting. He opened his mouth. She grasped him by the hair and poured half the cupful down his throat. He sputtered and fought.
"I won't take no more. 'Tain't the measles."
"Well, you'll die if 'tis and the rash don't break out."
He opened his mouth again and took the rest of the mullein tea. It was bitter, but not nearly as bad as some of her concoctions. The bitter brew she made from pomegranate peelings, or that from pitcher plant root, was infinitely worse. He lay back on his moss-stuffed pillow.
"If 'tis the measles, Ma, how soon will the rash come?"
"Soon as you get to sweating from the tea. Give her up."
She left the room, and he resigned himself to waiting for the sweat. Being sick was something of a treat. He wouldn't willingly go through the first night again when cramps had tied him in knots. But the convalescence, the solicitude of his mother and his father, was definitely pleasant. He felt a faint sense of guilt that he hadn't told about the briarberries. She would have given him a purge, and it would all have been over with by the next morning. Penny had done all the work of the clearing alone for 2 days. He had hitched old Caesar to the plow and plowed over the sugar cane and hilled it up, had worked the corn and the cow peas and the small patch of tobacco. He had hauled water from the sinkhole, cut wood, fed and watered the stock. But perhaps, Jody speculated, he did have the fever. Perhaps he was coming down with the measles. He felt his face and stomach. There was no rash yet, no sweat. He flounced back and forth in the bed to hurry the heating. He realized that he felt as well as ever, better, actually, than before the plenitude of meat had tempted him into overeating. He recalled the quantities of fresh sausage and of venison that he had eaten without his mother stopping him. Perhaps, after all, the briarberries had had nothing to do with it. He was sweating at last. He called,
"Hey, Ma, come see. The sweat's done come."
She came to him and examined him.
"You feel as good as I do," she said. "Get out in that bed."
He threw back the covers and stepped out onto the deerskin rug. For a moment, he was lightheaded.
"You feel all right?" she asked.
"Yes'm. Sort of weakified."
"Well, you ain't et nothing. Get into your shirt and breeches and come get you some dinner."
He dressed quickly and followed her to the kitchen. The food was still warm. She laid out biscuits for him and a plate of hash and poured him a cup of sweet milk. She watched him eat.
"I hoped you'd get up a little mite pacified," she said.
"Can I have some more hash, Ma?"
"I should say not. You've had enough now to fill an alligator."
"Where's Pa?"
"To the lot, I reckon."
He strolled in search of him. Penny was sitting idly, for once, on the gate.
"Well, son," he said, "you look right peart."
"I feel good."
"You ain't got the measles or the childbed fever or the smallpox?"
The blue eyes twinkled. Jody shook his head.
"Pa?"
"Yes, son."
"I don't figure there was nothing ailed me but green briar berries."
"That's about what I figured. I never said nothing to your Ma, for she's death on a bellyful of green briar berries."
Jody sighed with relief. Penny said,
"I've been sitting here studying. The moon'll be right in an hour or two. What say you and me get us a couple of bobs and go fishing?"
"In the creek?"
"I sort of craved to fish some of them sawgrass ponds over where old Slewfoot was feeding."
"I'll bet we can catch us a cattywampus in one of them ponds."
"We can sure pleasure ourselves trying."
They went together to the shed back of the house to gather their paraphernalia. Penny discarded an old hook and rigged 2 new ones. He cut short hairs from the tail of the deer he had shot and made lures of the gray and white wisps. He tied them invisibly to the fish hooks.
"If I was a fish, I'd strike at this myself," he said.
He went to the house and spoke briefly with his wife.
"Me and Jody is going bobbing for bass."
"I thought you was give out and Jody was ailing."
"That's why we're going fishing," he said.
She followed to the door and watched after them.
"If you don't get no bass," she called, "catch me a leetle bream I can fry crisp and eat bones and all."
"We'll not come back without something," he promised.
The afternoon was warm, but the way seemed short. In a way, Jody thought, fishing was better than hunting. It was not so exciting, but neither was there terror. The heart beat at a reasonable cadence. There was time to look about and see the increase of green leaves in the live oaks and magnolias. They stopped at a familiar pond. It was shallow from too long dryness. Penny found a grasshopper and threw it into the water. There was no strike. No hungry swirl of waters.
"I'm feared the fish has died out in here," he said. "These little old ponds in the middle of nowhere has always been a puzzlement to me. I can't see how the fish lives here, year on year."
He caught another grasshopper and hurled it without result.
"The poor fish," he said. "Helpless in a world of their own. Instead of fishing for 'em, I ought to come out here and feed 'em."
He lifted his bamboo rod over his shoulder.
"Maybe the Lord figures the same about me," he chuckled. "Maybe he looks down and says, 'There's Penny Baxter, trying to make out on that clearing.'" He added, "But it's a good clearing. Likely the fish is as content as me."
Jody said,
"Look, Pa, there's people."
Human beings were a stranger sight in the lonely place of live oak islands and sawgrass ponds and prairies than the creatures. Penny shaded his eyes. A file of half a dozen men and women was entering the scrub road they had just left behind.
"It's the miner cans," he said, "hunting gophers."
Jody saw now the sacks over their shoulders. The small, dusty land turtles, whose deep burrows were an indication of the poorest soil, were the last food most inhabitants of the scrub considered edible.
"I've always wondered," Penny said, "didn't they make a medicine maybe out in the gophers? Don't seem like they'd come here clear from the coast to hunt them things just to eat."
"Let's slip back close and look at 'em," Jody said.
"I'd not pry on the poor things," Penny said. "The Minerkins is a people was mighty bad put upon. My father knowed their hull history. A English feller carried him to New Smyrna over the ocean and the Indian River. He promised him a pure heaven and put him to work. And when times got bad and the crops failed, he left him to nigh about starved to death. There wasn't many left."
"Is they like gypsies?"
"No, for gypsies is wild. The men is dark like gypsies, but the women is fair when they're young. They mind their own business and live peaceable."
The procession disappeared into the scrub. Jody tingled and the hair stirred on the back of his neck. It was like seeing Spaniards. It was as though phantoms, dark and shadowy, and not men and women had passed before him, weighted with their strange burden of gophers and injustice. Penny said,
"Now, the bass, it ought to be thick as tadpoles in that pond right over there."
They were in territory a little west of the prairie's rim, where old Slewfoot had fed on fire plant. Dry weather had sucked up much of the water, and the marsh had broad areas that were now firm and dry. The ponds showed plainly. They had withdrawn from the sawgrass, and only lily pads troubled the water's surface. A blue peter ran across them, bright with yellow legs and painted face. A slight breath of air rippled across the marsh, and the water rippled under it. The lily pads tipped an instant, their broad shining leaves to the glint of the sun.
"Just enough of a riffle," Penny said, "and the moon just right."
He fastened lengths of line to the two poles and attached the deer hair bobs.
"Now, you work your bob across the north end, and I'll try the south. Don't make no fuss walking."
Jody stood a moment to watch his father make an expert cast across the pond. He marveled at the skill of the knotted hands. The bob lay at the edge of a cluster of lily pads. Penny began to jerk it slowly across the water. It dipped and bobbed with the irregular rhythm of a live insect. There was no strike, and Penny drew in his line and cast again in the same place. He called to invisible fish lurking near the weedy bottom.
"Now, Grandpappy, I can see you sitting there on your stoop." He jerked the bob more slowly. "You better lay down your pipe and come get your dinner."
Jody tore himself from the fascination of his father's performance and moved to his end of the pond. He cast badly for a time, tangling his line and laying the bob in the most unlikely places, overreaching the narrow pond and enmeshing the hook in the tough sawgrass. Then something of harmony came to him. He felt his arm swing in a satisfying arc, his wrist flexed at the proper moment. He laid the bob exactly where he had meant to, at the edge of a patch of switchgrass. Penny called,
"Mighty nice, son. Leave it lay just a minute. Then get ready the first second you jerk it."
He hadn't known his father was watching. He was tense. He jerked his pole cautiously, and the bob flipped across the water. There was a swirl. A silver form shot half clear of the water. An open mouth as big as a cook pot enveloped the bob. A weight like a millstone dropped at the end of his line, fought like a wildcat, and pulled him off balance. He braced himself against the frenzy to which he was irrevocably attached. Penny called,
"Take it easy. Don't let him get under them bonnets. Keep the tip of your pole up. Don't give him no slack."
Penny left him to the struggle. His arms ached from the strain. He was afraid to tug too hard for fear of breaking the line. He dared not yield an inch for fear a sudden slackness would tell of the loss of the giant. He longed for magic words from his father indicating some miracle by which he might land his fish and be done with the torment. The bass was sulking. It made a dash for the grasses, where it might tangle the line around their stems and so rip free. It came to Jody that if he walked around the edge of the pond, keeping a taut line, he might lead the bass into shallow water and flounder him at the edge. He worked cautiously. He was tempted to drop the pole and clutch the line itself and come to grips with his adversary. He began to walk away from the pond. He gave his pole a heave and landed the bass, flouncing in the grass. He dropped the pole and ran to move the catch to a final safety. The bass would weigh 10 pounds. Penny came to him.
"Boy, I'm proud of you. Nobody couldn't have handled him better."
Jody stood panting. Penny thumped him on the back as excited as he. He looked down, unbelieving, at the stout form and the great maw.
"I feel as good as if 'twas old Slewfoot," he said,
and they grinned together and pummeled each other's backs.
"Now, I got to go beat you," Penny said.
They took separate ponds. Penny called that he was licked and beaten. He began fishing for Ma Baxter's bream with a hand line and bonnet worms. Jody cast and cast again, but there was never the mad swirl of waters, the great leap, the live and struggling weight. He caught a small bass and held it up to show his father.
"Throw him back," Penny called. "We don't need him for eating. Leave him to grow up big as the other one. Then we'll come back again and catch him."
Jody put the small fish back reluctantly and watched it swim away. His father was stern about not taking more of anything, fish or game, than could be eaten or kept. Hope of another monster dwindled as the sun finished its spring arc of the daylight sky. He cast leisurely, taking his pleasure in his increasing dexterity of arm and wrist. The moon was now wrong. There was no longer feed time. The fish weren't striking. Suddenly, he heard his father whistle like a quail. It was the signal they used together in squirrel hunting. Jody laid down his pole and looked back to make sure he could identify the tuft of grass where he had covered his bass from the rays of the sun. He walked cautiously to where his father beckoned. Penny whispered,
"Foller me. We'll ease up closest as we dare."
He pointed.
"The hoopin' cranes is dancin'."
Jody saw the great white birds in the distance. His father's eye, he thought, was like an eagle's. They crouched on all fours and crept forward slowly. Now and then Penny dropped flat on his stomach and Jody dropped behind him. They reached a clump of high sawgrass, and Penny motioned for concealment behind it. The birds were so close that it seemed to Jody he might touch them with his long fishing pole. Penny squatted on his haunches, and Jody followed. His eyes were wide. He made a count of the whooping cranes. There were 16. The cranes were dancing a cotillion as surely as it was danced at Volusia. Two stood apart, erect and white, making a strange music that was part cry and part singing. The rhythm was irregular like the dance. The other birds were in a circle. In the heart of the circle, several moved counterclockwise. The musicians made their music. The dancers raised their wings and lifted their feet, first one and then the other. They sunk their heads deep in their snowy breasts, lifted them, and sunk again. They moved soundlessly, part awkwardness, part grace. The dance was solemn. Wings fluttered, rising and falling like outstretched arms. The outer circle shuffled around and around. The group in the center attained a slow frenzy. Suddenly, all motion ceased. Jody thought the dance was over, or that the intruders had been discovered. Then the two musicians joined the circle. Two others took their places. There was a pause. The dance was resumed. The birds were reflected in the clear marsh water. 16 white shadows reflected the motions. The evening breeze moved across the sawgrass. It bowed and fluttered. The water rippled. The setting sun lay rosy on the white bodies. Magic birds were dancing in a mystic marsh. The grass swayed with them, and the shallow waters, and the earth fluttered under them. The earth was dancing with the cranes, and the low sun, and the wind, and the sky. Jody found his own arms lifting and falling with his breath as the crane's wings lifted. The sun was sinking into the sawgrass. The marsh was golden. The whooping cranes were washed with gold. The far hammocks were black. Darkness came to the lily pads, and the water blackened. The cranes were whiter than any clouds or any white bloom of oleander or of lily. Without warning, they took flight. Whether the hour-long dance was simply done, or whether the long nose of an alligator had lifted above the water to alarm them, Jody couldn't tell. But they were gone. They made a great circle against the sunset, whooping their strange, rusty cry that sounded only in their flight. Then they flew in a long line into the west and vanished. Penny and Jody straightened and stood up. They were cramped from the long crouching. Dusk lay over the sawgrass so that the ponds were scarcely visible. The world was shadow, melting into shadow. They turned to the north. Jody found his bass. They cut to the east to leave the marsh behind them, then north again. The trail was dim in the growing darkness. It joined the scrub road, and they turned once more east, continuing now in a certainty, for the dense growth of the scrub bordered the road like walls. The scrub was black, and the road was a dark gray strip of carpet, sandy and soundless. Small creatures darted across in front of them and scurried in the bushes. In the distance, a panther screamed. Bull bats shot low over their heads. They walked in silence. At the house, bread was baked and waiting, and hot fat was in the iron skillet. Penny lighted a fat wood torch and went to the lot to do his chores. Jody scaled and dressed the fish at the back stoop, where a ray of light glimmered from the fire on the hearth. Ma Baxter dipped the pieces in meal and fried them crisp and golden. The family ate without speaking. She said, "What ails you fellers?" They did not answer. They had no thought for what they ate nor for the woman. They were no more than conscious that she spoke to them. They had seen a thing that was unearthly. They were in a trance from the strong spell of its beauty. Chapter 11. The fawns were being born. Jody saw through the scrub the delicate tracery of their small pointed hooves. Wherever he went, to the sinkhole, for wood into the blackjacks south of the lot, to the traps, Penny was obliged to keep about for varmints. He walked with eyes on the ground, watching for signs of their comings and their goings. The larger hoof marks of the does usually preceded them. But the does were wary. Often the doe sign was in one place, where the mother had fed alone, and the wavering fawn sign was some distance away, where the infant had been left in the greater safety of heavy cover. Often there were twin fawns. When Jody found the double set of tracks, he could scarcely contain himself. He thought always then, "I could leave one for the mammy and take one for myself." He broached the matter to his mother one evening. "Ma, we got milk aplenty. Can't I get me a little old fawn for a pet for me? A spotted fawn, Ma, can't I?" "I should just say not. What do you mean, milk aplenty? There ain't an extra drop left from sun to sun." "It could have my milk." "Yes, and fatten the blasted fawn, and you grow up puny. Much as we all got to do, what on earth do you want with one of them things, blating around here day and night?" "I want one. I want a coon. But I know a coon gets mischievous. I'd love a bear cub, but I know they're liable to be mean. I just want something." He puckered his face so that his freckles ran together. "I just want something all my own. Something to foller me and be mine." He struggled for words. "I want something with dependence to it." His mother snorted. "Well, you'll not find that nowhere. Not in the animal world, nor in the world of man. Now, Jody, I'll not have you pestering me. You say another word, fawn or coon or bear cub, and I'll take a breast to you." Penny listened quietly from his corner. In the morning he said, "We'll go hunt us a buck today, Jody. Likely we'll find a fawn bedding. It's near about as much pleasure seeing 'em wild as having 'em tame."
"Will we take both dogs?"
"Nobody but old Julia. She ain't had a workout since she was hurt. A slow hunt'll do her good."
Ma Baxter said, "That last venison didn't last no time. But we did jerk right smart of it, come to think of it. Get a few hams in the smokehouse, and it'll look natural again."
Her good nature rose and fell with the food supply. Penny said, "Jody, looks like you fell heir to the old muzzle loader. But don't get too put out now. Do it fail you like it failed me." He couldn't imagine being impatient about it. It was enough to have the use of it for himself. His mother had sewed the cream-colored coonskin into a knapsack for him. He filled it with shot and caps and wadding and filled the powder horn. Penny said, "Ma, I've been studying. I just about got to go to Volusia to get my shell cases. Lem only throwed in a few shells with a gun, and I'd love some rail coffee. I've had a bait of them wild coffee beans."
"Me too," she agreed, "and I need me some thread and a paper of needles."
"Now the bucks," he said, "seems to be feeding toward the river. I've been seeing a perfect shower of tracks heading that away. I believe me and Jody can hunt on in that direction. And do we get us a buck or two, we can trade the saddles and haunches to Volusia for what we need. Then we can say howdy to Grandma Hutto." She frowned.
"You'll get to visiting with that sassy old woman, and like as not you'll be gone a couple of days. I think you'd ought to leave Jody with me."
Jody squirmed and looked at his father. Penny said, "We'll be back tomorrow. How's Jody to learn to hunt and be a man if his daddy don't carry him along and learn him?
"It's a good excuse," she said. "It's just men folks liking to prowl off together."
"Then you come and make the hunt with me, sweetheart, and leave Jody here."
Jody laughed out. The picture of his mother's great frame pushing through the bay heads made him shout in spite of himself.
"Oh, go on," she said, and laughed. "Get it over and done with."
"You know you enjoy getting shut of us now and again," Penny told her.
"It's my only rest," she admitted. "Leave me Grandpa's gun loaded."
The ancient Long Tom, Jody thought, was more of a menace to her than to any intruders.
She was an inaccurate and incompetent shot, and the gun was as fallible as Penny's muzzle loader, but he could understand the comfort to her of its presence.
He brought it from the shed for his father to load, grateful that she had not demanded his own newly acquired piece. Penny whistled to old Julia, and the man and the boy and the hound set out eastward in mid-morning. The May day was warm and close. The sun beat down through the scrub. The small hard leaves of the scrub oaks were flat pans to hold the heat. The sand burned Jody's feet through his cowhide shoes. In spite of the heat, Penny walked at a fast gait. It was all Jody could do to follow him. Julia loped ahead. There was as yet no scent. Penny stopped once and stared about the horizon. Jody asked,
"What do you see, Pa?"
"Nothing, son, and very little of that."
A mile east of the clearing, he changed his direction. There were suddenly deer tracks in a great plenty. Penny studied them for size and sex and freshness.
"Here's two big old bucks traveling together," he said at last. "They come this way before day."
"How can you tell about tracks so?"
"Just by being used to 'em."
Jody could see little difference between them and some of the other hoof marks. Penny stooped and traced them with his finger.
"Now you know to tell a doe from a buck. A doe's track is pointed and fine, and everyone can tell how fresh a track be, for an old track has sand blowed into it. And now, if you'll notice, a deer's toes is spraddled when he's running. They're close together when he walks." He indicated the fresh tracks to the hound. "Here, Julia, get him."
Julia bent her long nose to the trail. It led out of the scrub, toward the southeast, into an open area of gallberry flats. Here was bear sign as well. Jody asked,
"Must I shoot a bear? Do I get to chance it?"
"Bear or buck, it's all right. Just be sure you got a good chance at. Don't go wasting your shot."
The flats were not hard going, but the sun was blazing. The gallberry bushes ended, and there was a welcome stretch of pines. The shadows were cooling. Penny pointed out a bear gnaw. It was a clawed area on a tall pine tree, shoulder high to a man. The resin dripped from it.
"I've watched a bear at it," Penny said, "many a time. He'll stretch up and he'll claw. He'll turn his head sideways and he'll nag and gnaw. Then he'll back up and rub his shoulders agin the resin. Some folks says it's to keep the bees from stinging when he robs a bee tree, but I've allus figured 'twas just a way of boasting. A buck'll boast just about the same way. He'll rub his head and horns agin a sapling just to prove itself."
Julia lifted her nose, and Penny and Jody stopped short. There was a commotion ahead. Penny motioned Julia to heel, and they crept close. An opening showed, and they halted. Twin bear cubs were high in a slim pine sapling, using it for a swing. The sapling was tall and limber, and the yearling cubs were rocking it back and forth. Jody had swung in the same fashion. For an instant, the cubs were not bears, but boys like himself. He would have liked to have climbed the sapling and rock with them. It bent halfway to the ground as they swung their weight, swayed upright again, then low on the other side. The cubs made now and then an amiable talking. Julia couldn't resist barking. The cubs stopped their play, astonished, and stared down at the humans. They weren't alarmed. It was their first sight of mankind, and they seemed to feel, as Jody felt, only curiosity. They cocked their black furry heads from one side to the other. One scrambled to a higher limb, not for safety, but for a better view. He curled one arm around the sapling and gaped down below him. His black, beady eyes were bright.
"Oh, Paw," Jody begged, "let's catch us one."
Penny himself was tempted.
"They're a mite big for taming." He brought himself to his senses. "Now what ails us? Just how long would it take your ma to run him off and me and you with him?"
"Paw, look at him cut his eyes."
"That's likely the meaning. Of twin bear cubs, one'll be gentle and the other be mean."
"Let's catch the gentle one, please, Paw."
The cubs craned their necks. Penny shook his head.
"Come along, boy. Let's get on with our hunt and lead them to their play."
He lingered behind while his father took up the buck's trail again. He thought once that the cubs were about to come down the sapling to him, but they only scrambled about from one limb to another and turned their heads to watch him.
He ached to touch them.
He imagined them sitting on their haunches and begging, as Oliver Hutto described trained bears as doing, nesting in his lap, warm and furry and intimate, sleeping on the foot of his bed, even under the covers with him, if the nights were cold. His father was almost out of sight under the pines. He ran after him. He looked back over his shoulder and waved his hand to the bear cubs. They lifted their black noses, as though the air might tell them what their eyes had not, the nature of their observers. In their first sign of alarm, he saw them clamber down the sapling and slip away to the west beyond the gallberries. He caught up to his father.
"Do you ever ask your ma into leaving you have such as that?" Penny told him. "You belong to get one young enough to train easy."
The thought was encouraging. The yearling cubs would indeed be large to handle.
"Now, I never had nothing much to pet nor play with, neither," Penny said. "There was such a mess of us. Neither farming nor the Bible pays a man too good. Pa was like your ma. He just wouldn't feed no critters. He done well to fill our bellies. Then he put in and died, and since I was the oldest rat in the barn, I had to look after the rest of them till they was old enough to shuffle around for theirselves."
"Well, a bear cub would near about make his own living, couldn't he?"
"Yes, offen your ma's chickens."
Jody sighed and applied himself with his father to the buck tracks. The pair of deer was keeping close together. It was odd, he thought, that the bucks could be so friendly through the spring and summer. Then when their horns were grown and they began to run with the does in the autumn, they would drive the fawns away from the does and battle fiercely. One buck was larger than the other.
"That and there's a buck big enough to ride," Penny said.
A patch of hammock joined the pines. Dogbane grew thickly here, lifting its yellow bells. Penny studied the multitude of tracks.
"Now, boy," he said, "you've been wanting to see fawns? Me and Julia will go on and make a circle. You climb up this here live oak and scrooch down in the branches, and I believe you'll see something. Hide your gun here in the bushes. You'll not want it."
Jody settled himself halfway up the live oak. Penny and Julia disappeared. The shade of the oak was cool. A light breeze moved through its leaves. Jody's shaggy hair was wet. He pushed it out of his eyes and wiped his face on his blue sleeve, then settled himself to quiet. Silence took over the scrub. Far away, a hawk cried shrilly and was gone. No bird stirred in any branches, no creature moved or fed, no bees droned or any insect. It was high noon. Everything living was resting in the heat of the sun's meridian. Everything except Penny and old Julia, who moved now somewhere among the scrub oaks and the myrtle. Bushes crackled below him. He thought his father was returning. He almost betrayed himself with a quick movement. A bleat sounded. A fawn was moving from under the protection of a low clump of palmettos. It must have been there all the time. Penny had known. Jody held his breath. A doe bounded over the palmettos. The fawn ran to her, wobbling on unsteady legs. She bent her head to it and made a low sound in greeting. She licked its small, anxious face. It was all eyes and ears. It was spotted. Jody had never seen one so young. The doe threw up her head and tasted the air with her wide nostrils. A taint lay on it of the human enemy. She kicked up her heels and made a sortie about the live oak. She discovered the trail of hound and man. She followed it backward and forward, throwing up her head at every few steps. She stopped and listened, her ears pricked tall above her great luminous eyes. The fawn bleated, the doe quieted. She seemed satisfied that the danger had come and gone. The fawn nuzzled her full udders and began to nurse. It butted her bag with its knobby head and switched its short tail in a gluttonous ecstasy. The doe wasn't content. She broke away from it and moved directly underneath the live oak. The boughs below Jody obscured his view, but he could see that she had traced his scent to the tree and was lifting her head to locate him. Her nose followed the odor of his hands, the leather of his shoes, the sweat of his clothing as surely as a man's eyes followed a blazed trail. The fawn followed, greedy for the warm milk. Suddenly the doe wheeled and kicked the fawn sprawling into the bushes. She cleared them in a great bound and galloped away. Jody scrambled down from his perch and ran to the place where he had seen the fawn tumble. It wasn't there. He hunted the ground carefully. The tiny hoof marks crossed and crisscrossed, and he couldn't tell one track from another. He sat down disconsolately to wait for his father. Penny returned, red of face and wet with sweat.
"Well, son," he called, "what'd you see?"
"A doe and a fawn. The fawn were right here all the while. He nursed his mammy, and she smelled me and run off. And I can't find the fawn nowhere. You reckon Julia can track him?"
Penny dropped down on the ground.
"Julia can track everything that makes a trail. But don't let's torment the little thing. It's right close to this minute, and likely scared to death."
"Well, his mammy shouldn't have left him."
"That's where she was smart. Most everything would take out after her. And she's learned the fawn to lay up so still it'll not get noticed."
"It were mighty cute spotted, Pa."
"Was the spots all in a line or helter-skelter?"
"They was in a line."
"Then it's a little old buck fawn. Wasn't you proud to see it so close?"
"I was proud, but I'd sure love to catch 'em and keep 'em."
Penny laughed and opened his knapsack and took out the lunch. Jody protested. He was for once more anxious to hunt than to eat. Penny said,
"We got to noon somewhere, and a deer is mighty likely to run over us right here. When you noon, you're just as good to noon where the game walks."
Jody brought his gun from its hiding place and sat down to eat. He was abstracted, and only the flavor of fresh briarberry jam brought him back to a consciousness of his food. The jam was thin and not sweet enough, sugar being scarce. Old Julia was still a little weak. She lay stretched out on her side. Her battle scars showed white against her dark hide. Penny lay on his back. He said lazily,
"Them two bucks is like to circle back through here to bed up right soon, if the wind don't change. If you was of a notion to go climb one of them high pine trees about a quarter to the east, it'd make a mighty good stand."
Jody picked up his gun and started away. He would give anything to bring down a buck alone. Penny called after him,
"Don't try for too long a shot. Take your time, and don't let the gun kick you out in the tree."
Tall, scattered pines lifted ahead from a desolate flat of gallberry bushes. Jody chose one that commanded a view of a wide area. Nothing could cross in any direction without his seeing it. It was hard work to climb the straight trunk with a gun in one hand. His knees and shins were raw when he reached the lowest branches. He rested a moment, then climbed as high as he dared in the treetop. The pine swayed in an imperceptible breeze. It seemed alive, stirring with a breath of its own. He recalled the bear cubs rocking the sapling. He began to swing his treetop, but it was overbalanced with his weight and that of his gun. It cracked ominously, and he held quiet. He looked about him. He knew now how a hawk felt, surveying the world from high places. An eagle stared down as he was staring, high and wise and predatory and keen. He swung his head in a slow circle. For the first time, he could believe that the world was round. By turning his head quickly, he could almost see the whole horizon at once. He thought that his vision covered the entire area. He was startled to see movement. He had seen nothing approaching. But a large buck was feeding toward him. Early huckleberries were offering food. The buck was still out of range. He debated climbing down from the pine tree and stalking it, but knew that the animal, more alert than he, would be gone before he could lift his gun. He could only wait and pray that it would feed within a reasonable distance. It moved with a maddening slowness. For a time, he thought it meant to feed away from him, to the south. Then it began to move directly toward him. He brought his gun up behind the shelter of the branches. His heart pounded. He couldn't tell for the life of him whether the deer was near or far. It loomed large, yet he was conscious that such details as eyes and ears were still not plain to him. He waited for what seemed an interminable period. The buck lifted his head. Jody drew a bead on the stout neck. He pulled the trigger. At the instant that he did so, he realized that he had not made sufficient allowance for his height above the game. He had overshot. Yet it seemed to him that he must have touched the animal, for it leaped into the air with something more than alarm. It cleared the gallberry bushes with a high bounding, making long cradled arcs. It passed directly under the pine tree. If he had had his father's new double-barreled gun, he would have had another shot. In a few seconds, he heard Penny's gun. He was quivering. He climbed down from the pine and pushed his way back to the patch of hammock. The buck lay in the shade of the live oak. Penny had already begun the dressing. Jody called.
Did I hit him?
You hit him. You done a mighty good job. Like as not, he'd have fell a piece on, but I taken the shot at him as he come by just to make sure. You was a mite high.
I know it. The minute I shot, I knowed I was high.
Well, that's the way you learn. Next time, you'll know. Now, here's your shot here, and there's mine.
Jody knelt down to examine the fine frame. Again, a sickness came over him at the sight of the glazed eyes and the bleeding throat. He said,
I wished we could get our meat without killing it.
It's a pity, all right. But we got to eat.
Penny was working deftly. His hunting knife, a flat saw file, ground down to an edge, with only a corn cob for handle, was not overly sharp, but he had already drawn the venison and cut off the heavy head. He skinned it below the knees, crossed the legs and tied them, slipped his arms through the junctures, and stood up with a carcass neatly balanced on his back for carrying.
Now, Boyles may want the hide when we skin it out at Volusia, he said. But if you'd like to carry the hide to Grandma Hutto for a present, we'll just refuse him.
I reckon she'll be proud to have it for a rug, all right. I wished I'd shot it by myself to give her.
That's just all right. The hide's yours. I'll carry her a four-quarter for my portion. She's got nobody but us to hunt for, with Oliver gone to sea. That mindless Yankee hangs around her is no good for sich as that, Penny said innocently. Now maybe you'd rather carry the hide to your sweetheart.
Jody scowled blackly.
Pa, you know I got no sweetheart.
You ain't going back to Eulalie after I seed you holding hands at the doings?
I was not holding hands. It was a game they was playing. If you say that again, Pa, I'll just die.
Penny seldom teased his son, but now and then an occasion was irresistible.
Grandma's my sweetheart, Jody said.
All right, I just wanted to get it straight.
The sand road was long and hot. Penny was wet with sweat, but he walked easily under his burden. Jody said,
Can I tote it a ways?
But Penny shook his head.
These fellers only fits a man's back, he said.
They crossed Juniper Creek, Then, after 2 miles of narrow road, picked up the main road to the river and to Volusia. Penny stopped to rest. In late afternoon, they passed Captain McDonald's